I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, an opportunity to transcend the binary, negate the debate, and play instead at the level of creation itself. It's not too late to bend reality to the higher collective will. Everything's alive and counting on us to rise to the occasion. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you're on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, storyteller and mage, my longtime friend, Grant Morrison.
I just love looking at the world through different lenses, and I found that some of the magical lenses are really good for triggering new ways of thinking.
Grant and I will be considering the magical power of art and storytelling. It's time to intervene on behalf of people. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and we're all on Team Human. We launched our new simplified website this week. Thanks to Luke for building it. It's just one more thing we're able to do thanks to the kind support of Team Human subscribers, including Rabbi Rami, Kirsten Corver, Paul, Sean Humphreys, and Andrew Bishop, who all get free stuff, ebooks, access to our Discord discussions, and access to our premium episodes. This week, it's the 2-hour marathon discussion I had with philosopher Terence McKenna back in 1993 when I was working on MediaVirus. Even if you're not a subscriber, take a listen to the preview of that episode in our regular feed. He was amazing on stage and in talks, but to hear him think aloud in a one-on-one conversation is really, it's amazing. You can become a paying subscriber by going to teamhuman.fm and clicking on the support button in the top right corner. We heard from some listeners and had a good discussion on Discord, and I agree with the community that last week's episode, while interesting, doesn't really feel Team Human to me. So we took it down from the permanent public collection of shows. Subscribers can still hear it on Patreon, but I don't think it represents our values as a team. You can read more about the decision at patreon.com/teamhuman. I've been overwhelmed with the news this past week. Ruth Bader Ginsburg's passing, COVID's resurgence, Trump's commitment to remain president no matter the electoral outcome, the Breonna Taylor verdicts, the television fiasco passing for political debate. And I've got something so great to share on this episode of Team Human. I kind of prefer, rather than doing a whole monologue, to just take a breath. And insulating space to separate this conversation from the mundane, chaotic atrocity around us, and see if we can't immerse ourselves in something entirely different, refreshing, and affirming. And what could be more affirming than the reunion of two people who just love to be together? It's my true pleasure, an offering really, to invite you to the conversation I just had with my old dear friend Grant Morrison. He doesn't really do media, nothing like this anyway, and it's much less an interview than a reunion under duress. Grant Morrison wrote comics including The Invisibles, We Three, The Filth, tons of Batman and Superman, and also the TV shows Happy and Brave New World. He's everywhere. He's also known for his magical practice and mass popularization of sigils. We met first in the mid-90s, I guess, on the tour for a collection of psychedelic rave fiction called Disco 2000, in which we'd both participated. I don't remember a lot about that tour except getting high in a big round bathtub with him and his partner at the time, Victoria Beatty. But we'd already crossed paths in the Unimind, with him footnoting my Siberia in his comic series The Invisibles, and me becoming a fan of his comics since he wove Borges into the series Doom Patrol. We tend to have our deep, long, crazy conversations during major global crises, like right after 9/11, and this one is no exception. I think most of the things we refer to make sense on their own, but if something doesn't, just ask me in the Discord, and I'm happy to explain. So here's Grant Morrison speaking from one of the giant rooms in his home in Scotland.
Hey, how you doing?
All right. Look at you. Oh, my gosh. It feels so... I miss you.
It's been a long time. I miss everyone in America. I haven't been to America since last November, and it gets to me, you know. It's kind of all my friends are there.
Yeah, well, a lot of them anyway. How are you doing in pandemic times?
It's been the same, and I'm writing, so I've always been self-isolating. You know what it's like. But that's the condition of the writer's life, is to self-isolate. So it's easy, you know, it's easy to just disappear into what you do. But it must be hell for people who are in just an apartment and they cannot get out, and they're just confined by this, and they don't have a way out of it, or a hobby that keeps them going.
I know. Americans are particularly angry about that. They feel like it's, you know, the state coming down from outside, controlling their...
Well, they do, because they've got to impose that there's got to be some rational to it, but it's not. It's nature is coming down, and nature's coming down hard, you know.
She's pissed off. I mean,
very much so, and it's pretty obvious by now, I should think, you know, but people are still in denial. And it's funny, it really is like if there was a zombie apocalypse or an alien invasion tomorrow, most people would just say it wasn't happening. Even as they were being rounded up, even as they've been herded into the flying saucers or chased down the street by the zombies, they would just be saying, no, this is some government thing. This is just some means of trying to control the population. They've already got the population under control. They did that a long time ago. They don't really need any of these stunts to do anymore.
I know, except in some ways, these things like the COVID are making people more aware of the underlying government control. In some ways, all the QAnon people, they're not specifically right, but they're thematically right.
Well, the odd and interesting thing about that to me, I think, is the fact that so much of what would have been, say, you know, in The Invisibles in the 90s has now migrated to this other, you know, it's what we thought was a kind of, you know, lefty punk rebellion. It's turned into quite a different type of thing, but using a lot of the exact same methods, the magic, the terminology, the language, the framing of the conceptual war between, you know, the old and the corrupt and the new and the revolutionary. And it's weird that it migrated to the other side. They used the magic better than we did.
They do. That's, you know, and that was, in some ways, I was just listening back to our DisinfoCon stuff in preparation to see you again. And I listened to even my talk. I got up there and I said, we won. The counterculture won.
Yeah.
But we've got to let them in now. We can't, you know, that we're all like, oh, fuck you. You can't come on our side, George Bush. We don't like you. You have to suffer. And I said, no, we have to welcome them in. Otherwise, they're going to become the counterculture. And I feel like they did. Yeah, they took all our stuff.
We did win all the stuff we talked about. It won, you know, but it became the tools of a completely different agenda, I think. And that's interesting. You know, it's just as the left became more divided and more turned against itself, I think the right took up the ideas of magic to the point where the president lives in a world of magical thinking. It's just absolute. If I deny this, it will cease to be. You know, my will is stronger than reality. And even when it's not, I think he genuinely exists in that bubble where he truly believes that by thinking it hard enough, by repeating it again and again, it will become reality.
And there's some truth to that. There's some logic. I mean, it's the way magic works. He was raised in the church of Norman Vincent Peale.
Yeah, exactly.
The guy who wrote The Power of Positive Thinking.
The Power of Positive Thinking to overturn tornadoes, to turn back tides and fires. I mean, I think he truly has that in him. So yeah, I mean, it's to understand that clearly the magic has worked, and it's worked in a lot of interesting ways, but it's maybe time for some of the people on what used to be our side to reclaim it. And I don't like sides and I don't like binaries, but there's such a polarization right now that maybe everyone needs to kind of meet in the middle again using the same techniques.
I know. I always wanted to believe that bad people couldn't use magic. You know, that you had to have some sort of integrity and connection to Godhead.
Yeah, but we've all seen those movies where it's the Black Magician or Baron Mordo from Doctor Strange. You know, we should have known, we should have understood that they're equally good. And I mean, my idea was just to steal all their fashion stuff so that the cool magicians looked as scary and goth as the bad magicians. And that kind of worked for a while, but it wasn't a long-term sustaining
I know, and they do it now with camp. You know, that Melania Trump was on the Republican convention wearing a Nazi outfit.
Yeah. You know, signs and signifiers. She's trying to reclaim something, God knows what.
Yeah, but it's working. It's working. You know, it reminds me, you know, and I wanted to talk to you about Brave New World, because I just I had watched one, but then I what's it called? I binged it.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. I mean, it's so, and I mean this in a good, it's so different from how I saw the book, because I saw the book in kind of Huxley period, more like Brazil with weird wires and things. And this is so, it's a future. It's a believable sci-fi future. But the thing that made me sad was, in some ways, the world of Brave New World, where everybody knows everyone's thoughts and they have great fucking orgies, like
all the time.
Oh my God. And everything's clean and they get all the food they want. And there's people taking, you know, Amazon people taking care of it. It's like that. In some ways, that's the rave dream, that we would connect into one colonial organism. But in Great Brave New World, the only way we can get there is with drugs and extreme social control and, you know, and a class system. Were you just depicting that world, or do you feel like the only way to create that organismic sort of utopian human thing is that that's a false goal, that we really can't create one giant global rave?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's what we all hoped for 30 years ago, but no, going into Brave New World, it was very much, the approach was to let's treat it as a utopia, not a dystopia, and see what kind of filter that then provides. Like you say, it looks pretty cool from a lot of angles, you know. So the interest for me was to not tell one of those, you know, Marxist dystopian stories where basically there's this effete culture which has risen up and everybody's happy, but there's something inauthentic about that happiness. And into that will then come some figure of, you know, old school cowboy morality, who all he has to do is punch the effete leader in the nose and everybody suddenly realizes that what they really want is blood and guts and a fight in the saloon. And I just didn't want to tell that story. You know, it's been told so many times. I think of things like Elysium or Metropolis or I mean, you could name a dozen of them. So this one was about what if this is as good as it gets? What if they actually have reached the next level of organisation? But it's not finished. As you say, utopia is always on the horizon. And it seemed like there was something really interesting to explore the failure of that type. John the Savage tries to foment a Marxist revolution of the proletariat, but there is no proletariat. They're just like drones in a hive. They have been bred to love their work. And they don't want to be alphas. They don't want to be betas. That's too much work. That doesn't suit an epsilon's nature or his personality. The epsilons are happy to do those menial jobs because they've been bred that way. And so it was interesting to see that the attempt to create that, the revolution of the proles, found us, as it does in Huxley, it found us in the TV show. And it was very much to say, no, this effete civilization, this, you know, potentially bloodless, passionless thing, is equally as human, and all for all its conditioning, John the Savage is as conditioned by his mother, by the ideas of family, by all the old ideas of America in the series, which obviously in the book, the Savage Lands was a small Zuni Pueblo in New Mexico, and we expanded it to be all of America, and they secede from the world state back after the great catastrophe that takes out two-thirds of the population. So America secedes, and the idea was to put it almost in the position of where the Middle East is in regards to America, that suddenly you have this culture that's 300 years old trying to sustain when other people have moved on, when the rest of the culture has moved on to this higher degree of organisation. They are still trying to live out the American dream in a world where they've completely depopulated the continent, where everyone dies at the age of 30 because they're so sick, where a Mars bar costs $50,000 because of inflation, where there's been six presidents in the last 5 months. And it was that, you know, a kind of broken down version of what America is now, surviving into the future and daring to try and challenge this higher level. And that just seemed to make it much more interesting than the notion that one side was right and the other side was wrong. It was certainly that one side was more organised, but that organisation was not an end state. And perhaps the introduction of John and the lessons that he teaches allows Lenina in this version of the story, because we wanted to foreground the female perspective a lot more than Huxley does, obviously. And so she's the one who sees the potential for taking ideas and evolving her culture to an even higher degree of organisation, which we haven't seen yet. So that becomes the kind of hidden brave new world of the whole series.
And then, so how much do you do? And do you thought up the new approach and then like wrote up, you write a pitch? Because yeah, I guess the book's public domain, you can just do it?
No, it was we were asked to do it. You know, Brian Taylor and I, after we'd done Happy, and they kind of liked what we'd done with Happy, so they asked us both to come up with a pitch. And, you know, I seized on the science fiction aspects of it because that's my thing. So we did a pitch, and using that utopian idea, that's what people liked about it, because everyone else, I think, had come in and pitched the classic, oh, it's a dystopia, and all they need is a punch in the nose, and they'll learn how society really works. And we weren't going that route. So they liked that, and we got it, and we worked up a huge Bible of how the world would work and solved a lot of problems that Huxley had left, because he wasn't really thinking about it as, you know, there's a lot of things in there that don't quite line up. So we had to solve them, and out of that came a lot of, the most interesting ideas. But that chugged along for a while, and then David Weiner came in as a showrunner, and he was a playwright who'd worked on the Walking Dead stuff, and he just kind of dismantled it and rebuilt it, and he brought in the writer's room, and again, it was an amazing writer's room with a cosmologist in there. We had, you know, there was out of 11 people, 9 of them were women, so 8 of them were women. So it was very much like, what new ideas can we get to apply to this text? And out of that came the final version that you saw, which was very much, you know, guided by how David wanted to take the material that we had.
And then when they make it, do you get to go and see sets and things?
Yeah, well, I didn't have to, but we went down to London to see the pilot getting shot, and it was really fun. You know, they did it in one of those big corporate towers in the city of London, and it was pretty good to watch. But, you know, filming is boring. I prefer the writer's room was great, just sitting with writers every day. I couldn't do it all the time because I like to be on my own, but just the experience of being in there for months and being able to share ideas with people and seeing these other, you know, great minds coming up with stuff
right.
was amazing.
because they're crazy smart people. When you actually talked with them, like I've met some of the people who worked on like Westworld and the OA, and you can complain about the episodes, but you meet the people and they can stay. I thought I was smart. They can stay ahead of you in terms of references. and you know what I mean? They're really.
Yeah, well, no, they took it very seriously and they were living the book. So, you know, it was part of their lives for like 6 months. I was kind of dipping in and out to try and not have to do all the hard work. But they were in there for 6 months at a time and just really living through that book. So, yeah, I mean, I think there was a lot of great ideas went into it.
Yeah. And then you're still doing Happy.
No, that was done. They did 2 seasons and then UCP kind of dropped it. It's been quite successful on Netflix, but I don't know. There's talk of maybe doing a kind of feature-length conclusion to it because it did have an end that would have finished in one more season. But as usual, they just pulled the plug. But they kind of pulled the plug on everything at that point on Sci-Fi.
Because I'll tell you, of all your work, Happy is not the one I would have guessed that would have made it to television first and been successful. You know, I always thought The Invisibles, well, duh, that's like the series. Or We Three is another one. I mean, oh my God, with character animation they can do now, and it's a series because it's a picaresque adventure of these animals moving through. You could, and then Happy, I'm thinking, how the fuck are they gonna do that? And then it's the character, it's the thing is, the bunny man is in there fully animated, totally not real. I mean, Roger Rabbit level insanity. And then I realized it's nothing against you, but part of it is Chris Maloney is such, this is his great life's work. Chris Maloney, you know, the guy from Law and Order and Oz.
He was astonishing. You know, he was a human cartoon in that show. He was just, everything
I've never seen anything
constantly.
Like it. His face, it's like you're doing the animation to his face while it's going. Yeah.
And he was improvising all those scenes. I mean, most of the dialogue that you see him doing, he would improv and he would do it on every take. And you just had to select the best lines and you just leave him to it. He was amazing. But yeah, so there was that. But I've kind of enjoyed it. As I said, it's not, I wouldn't want to do it exclusively.
Right.
And doing the television stuff, but I've certainly enjoyed it, and I'm doing a couple more things. I know you're getting into that world as well now, aren't you?
Thinking, I mean, poking around, I've got meetings, you know, it's my great comic, The Testament, which I see as my life's work, that no one wants to touch.
That's,
you know,
the
Bible
thing, right?
And future and But ADD, you know, it looks like that's happening. They're just getting a showrunner. I'm following your advice. Get a showrunner, be at the beginning, and then kind of back off, because you're right. I mean, I'm better at idea generation and creating a book, but not, I don't know if I want to stay with something for years.
Well, it's also the showrunner job's pretty demanding. You know, they say that no one under 50 should do it if they don't want to die of a heart attack in the first 6 months. So it's certainly, I just don't have the skills for that. It involves a lot of liaison with production and working out things financially and numbers, which I have no chance of surviving in that world.
Right. Yeah, no, I know this one showrunner, Howard Gordon, who did Homeland and a bunch of good shows. And I went and visited him at his palatial estate in, you know, Beverly Hills or something. And I get there and he's lying on the bathroom floor saying, I can't do it. I can't do it. And this is one of the most, you know, he's 55, 60 years old, respected showrunners in the world. I was like, okay. But the other thing I wanted to ask you about, though, was the difference and similarity between working in comics and television. I mean, comics is I always felt with comics, we're reaching right into young people's minds. We're almost creating their mythological, their own, their internal pantheon that they're
absolutely
going to call
yeah.
on. You know, we're creating their gods.
Yeah, and a space for their gods to interact, you know, which in the space itself can be bigger than the gods. You're creating, like, the Marvel Universe, the DC Universe, the idea of creating entire, you know, entire universes, entire realities that then to frame these characters in, I think, is equally fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, for my first comic, I wanted to go back to the Bible. I thought, let me get the original Western superheroes and see how do they play. But television feels different. I mean, for me, comics created the characters that I used. My Ganesh, my Hanuman are in Kirby and DC and all around. But television was always more like
my dream space. It was like I dreamed television shows, Lost in Space and those things. It's like a different, do you feel like you're entering a different place in human consciousness or in the age or?
It's definitely bigger in the sense that the audience is bigger, so you know that the signal is going out much further. But it's less pure, you know, as I say, that working a television show, you are working with a showrunner, you're working with a lot of other people. It's, you have to let go of that sense of, you know, personal vision at some point, and it will always happen. So I think that it has that very different approach. It's more like being in a band. And comics is a band, but it's smaller. It's like, it's very much, you know, it's very much you and the artist. And I think there's a different, there's a purity to that that comes through, and there's a kind of, you get away with stuff. You can do first draft, like almost performance writing, and send it in because the production happens so quickly. Comics come out every month or bi-weekly even. So the work is done at a pace, and it's done in an almost unconscious jazz way, which makes it very different. I think that's what appeals to you when you're young. And, you know, the other thing I love about comics is the fact that there's a real interaction, a kind of holographic thing that happens, because they are only chicken scratchings. It's just ink. And it doesn't have music. It doesn't have people talking. It has little weird balloons with people's words transcribed in them. And yet, if you can get into that, something happens on the page. I think I've heard it described as that it engages the right and left hemispheres of the brain. Whether that theory has been completely discredited at this point, it still works as a great metaphor. It engages both hemispheres of the brain. You're processing visuals and you're processing the words actually written there. But what people also forget is the tactile quality of a comic, where you're actually holding the thing. There's an embrace. There's a connection with a comic that you don't have with any other media. And again, in that sense, it becomes a friend. It becomes animated by your participation in the way that a film can play in the background and it doesn't matter. But only you can read the comic. You know, only you can bring it to life. And so I think that gives it a much more intimate feeling, and these other media are not so much intended to be intimate. They're meant to, the signal's meant to go further, it's meant to touch more people. Therefore, it's the rough edges can be planed off. It's not aimed at little individuals sitting in a room suddenly connecting with some amazing New Gods or you know, Warlock comic. That's a different interaction. So I think that gives it the pop music kind of feel, and again, like I say, the tactile element of it, the touching of the artifact, I think is really important. And the control over time within a comic, where you can go back and forward and do what you like. You are in control of time. In a film or a play, you're dragged through. You know, there's no... Comics give you a higher dimensional perspective where you're actually able to move through time and see it as a whole, which I think is an actually pretty amazing model of the universe.
Yeah, in the comics, I love the idea that you can go back and look at a comic you've written and see stuff there that you didn't know you said.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, I know what I was working on there. Whereas I guess in television, there's so many people, everything, because there's so many things you're thinking about, and character A, character B, and the subplot, and the this, and get to there, and then before the commercial or the thing, that every choice that's made is really made, kind of, and reconsidered and argued.
Yeah,
and
1,000 times over 6 months of days, you know?
Right. And it's not to say that we're lazy, but it's like, in some ways, what your talent is conjuring the pure signal from... You know, wherever it is you come from, you know, whether it's your DNA or you know, in some quantum
and that's
reality.
It. In the comics, it's the immediacy of that, and the fact that the editing, there's not a lot of editing. The production moves too fast for there to be a lot of editing. And if you're good and if you've made money for them, then you get less edited all the time. So it's more like poetry in that sense as well. Like you say, it's really, it's the pure signal. It's stuff that you could not get through the distillation process of a television production or a film.
I mean, I wondered to relating it to real life. I've always wondered where you think things come from. I mean, it's sort of saying what's going on here on the big level. I mean, do you think that we're in some kind of a multiverse and that creativity is accessing ideas from other, you know, other possibilities? I mean, do you think it's just, we're just here and it's organic and, you know, and you're
imagining things or projecting things into reality?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love there to be a multiverse where there's a version of me that can run at the speed of light and all that stuff. I mean, that'd be great. And honestly, if there is a multiverse, shouldn't they have turned up by now just to check out and warn us of an impending crisis?
Totally, you'd think. One of the smarter ones.
This is Crisis on Infinite Earth, but the superheroes haven't turned up yet. It's kind of upsetting. But, I mean, without bringing all that into it, I mean, just using the Occam's razor, I have to just assume that human beings are evolved enough and we have so many connections in our brain, more so than most, that we are really good receivers, let's call it, for consciousness. Because I think consciousness is probably one of the intrinsic properties of the universe. Because when you think about it, you know, we talk about emergence and we say that, well, you know, a single bee isn't particularly intelligent, but if you have a hive of bees, then it's a working system and it has all its moving parts and it functions really well. So the more systems become complex, the more they develop at some kind of consciousness, some kind of awareness, and at the human level, a self-awareness, which is a meta-awareness, which I think gives us our power to connect previously unseen ideas in maybe ways that other animals do less of or don't do at all. So we have a skill that's particularly human to make connections, and making connections between seemingly unconnected ideas. You know, when the surrealists talked about that, the notion of the chance meeting of a sewing machine and an umbrella on a dissecting table has been the essence of surrealism, but also the essence of creativity, because then it's like, what story does the human mind tell about that? What pattern is then made by that juxtaposition? So I think our ideas come from there, but in terms of consciousness, I think it's an intrinsic thing, and we are pretty good at picking up on it, and we're pretty good at expressing it. In fact, we're made to express it at a quite high level, like I say, a meta level, which makes us a bit different from everyone else and gives us a sense of guilt and horror as well.
But it's like, except for maybe Superman, I haven't seen you deal much with like life after death sorts of stuff. I mean, because you don't really think much about that, do you? Or, you know, now that we're in late 50s, you might be almost 60 by now. I mean, do you think about what happens after?
I think all life is spent, if you're sensitive at all, your whole life is spent thinking about what happens when you're not around. But I don't have any proof of any kind of afterlife, so I can't place any faith or store in a certainty of it. When I had my kind of spiritual experience in Kathmandu, I had the absolute sense that I had understood it and that there was a higher dimensional unfolded version of me that I would then, at the point of death, unfold out into again. But it was much bigger than me, and this, whatever I am, was a tiny little compression of something, you know, much grander. It was a flattened down diagram almost of something that I might become in the afterlife. You know, and like DMT experience puts you in something that almost feels like a kind of afterlife. But the trouble is, all of our conscious experiences take place in life. Even people who, you know, have near-death experiences, they don't really die. So we actually have nothing to prove it. And with nothing to prove it, I can't really put much store in it. I mean, where do you sit on all that?
I'm hopeful, but doubtful.
But it's also, I mean, what do we imagine? What, they were going to wake up and sort of 26-year-old versions of our bodies, you know, and do what? You know, suddenly have the ability to fly around space and time looking like Doug or like Grant or being Doctor Who. I mean, it becomes what do we actually imagine it would be like, you know, to enter eternity?
Yeah.
Would we be anything like these little people? Would we even want to be, you know, to be these little, the universe poured into a bottle?
No, but, you know, I keep thinking, I always think that we'll get the Bardos, you know, the Tibetan Book of the Dead stuff.
Yeah, because they're so miserable and like that's just like a pure ordeal. So I imagine we'll get them. But I think they're happening at the edge of consciousness when consciousness is breaking down and all the neurons are going out, which I think will be quite an alarming and an interesting experience.
Yeah.
You know, and those of us who have experienced kind of ego death states of consciousness might have some prep for that. But I think it'd be very hard to imagine that very last spark going out and the vast emotional, you know, the primal, unspeakable emotion that will be attached to that moment and how that might come across, you know, as a revelation, as an eternal moment of either heaven or hell, who knows, you know. But no. The bad though is definitely because they're just like, oh God, I'm dead now, I've got to go through this.
Yeah, but you know, some of the bardos are really tempting. I mean, my problem, yeah, I'm not afraid
ones,
of them.
But you know you're going to go to that red one
I'm
just
totally
to see
it. Totally! Like, I've not gotten enough sex in this lifetime to I don't know that a lifetime could, to not jump into the orgy one, you know.
Yeah, well, definitely that's the one you'd be headed for. I think I might be drawn towards that, but you end up getting stuck in there as well.
Yeah. The other problem with it is by the time you die or in the bardos, chances are you've been so weak. I mean, you're like lying there with cancer and sick and all. So, you know, I certainly hope if I do the bardos, they're abstracted from the whatever pain my body's in at that moment. Because who wants to go through it while you're suffering, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, I guess everyone has in one way or another, you know, until recently when we had effective anesthetics. But I don't know. The death process might be so fabulous, you wouldn't want to give it up. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, I know Timothy Leary was hoping it would be fabulous and was all prepared, designed for dying and all. And about 2 or 3 weeks before it finally happened, he was like, "Oh, fuck all this. Get me the morphine. Get me the fentanyl." But no Buddhists, no monks.
And that is how we would be. I mean, the real truth, because I always thought I'd reach a certain age and I'd be like Gandalf and it would be kind of all behind me, all the fears and the worries, and I'd have kind of processed it all out, everything I've done to get over that. But it does.
I was hoping you would too.
Yeah, I know, but I'm sorry I've let everyone down yet again.
Yeah, well.
I think everyone just, you know, but if you're maybe some major guy, you've got to pretend you're not as scared.
I mean, you worked at it, though. You did enough sigil magic and everything else that, you know, if you didn't kind of find an escape hatch, I don't know that there is one.
Well, and I might be right about we're simply almost like game sprites in relation to something much higher, an unfolded version of ourselves which exists above space and time. And I think there is the only evidence I have apart from that experience from it is just the undeniable reality that inside my tiny little skull are infinities, like infinities upon infinities inside all of our skulls, which leads me to believe there's an undeniable higher dimensional aspect to us in there. Because what is it otherwise? It's the space is immense. We can fit anything in. We can fit the DC multiverse. We can add the Marvel multiverse. We can add, what if there was multiverse times 1,000,000? And our heads still kind of hold these concepts. So inside there is more than there is outside, and that's kind of undeniable. But what is that inside? And I guess that, you know, that's part of what all our explorations have been, is to try and figure out what exactly is that immense space in there and what else lives in there, perhaps, you know, and what does it imply as who we are and the dimensions that we have within us?
Yeah, I mean, I've been taking some comfort in Terence McKenna's idea that we're more of a transceiver than we are the thing. So when we're looking inside, we're not really looking inside. We're looking at resonating coils to some, you know, other quantum state.
Yeah,
which
and
would
also
be nice.
We're undeniably a part of an organism that includes all of us. You know, add the time dimension, and there's no escape from that. We all came from the same mitochondrial cell. We're all actually connected in time, but we feel divided in the same way. You know, if you put a hand through a flat plane, the singular object will become four circles. Each of those four circles, that's us. And I think to remind ourselves that we're all part of the hand is the next great task for humanity, to get beyond the terrible sense of division that's inflicted upon everything right now. But I do think we're undeniably little parts of something bigger. So again, we might just become more of the consciousness of the whole when we die. The same way that every time a skin flake comes off my hand, you know, that's a beautiful little organism that's filled with its own biological machinery that worked away for all this time, and it just sloughs off dead and drops to the floor and I don't even notice it. But you know, that's like us. I'm still here, and another one like it will take my place, will take its place, and will take my place, another one like me.
I mean, the sense of a connection to a whole is part of what makes
a whole lot of things make sense. What makes magic make sense? All the sense of coincidence. And it's like, oh, it's not a coincidence. You're looking at your own fucking hand is why you think
exactly.
It's a coincidence.
You know, and it's not reincarnation. It's just you getting a signal from another part of the giant structure. You know, suddenly you got a Napoleon signal because right over there, Napoleon's still happening as part of this structure. So there's a lot of things like that that become easy to understand and quite physical. Because I don't have a whole much truck with the supernatural at all after all the investigations over the years. And I think everything is explicable, but it doesn't necessarily make it any less wondrous. It just makes it even more wondrous to me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like I know the amazing Randy people and all, and, you know, quashing out any superstition. But it's like, for the people that want to find something, it's like, isn't this weird enough already?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And it's their charming need for there to be more that's almost sadder. The rest of us have been through that and realized you don't need more. It's all, you know, all the magic you need, you got. You know, it's right here in front of you, and saying, well, that's that. A man can't make an elephant disappear. Well, he probably can't. But he can possibly make you think you have witnessed the disappearance of an elephant, which is just about as good. And if they've understood it in terms of, you know, all the magic of the past was about, if you wanted to raise a demon, you would perform a certain series of operations. Now, the fact is, those series of operations will generally give you the same demon every time. So it actually functions, it really works. It's like if you conjure Hermes, you're unlikely to get Kali. Because you've done all the work to make a Hermes state of consciousness happen. The fact that it can be repeated, I find, is like fascinating. People don't talk about it, but you can repeat. Magicians have things called spells, you know, which are like formulae and produce desired results pretty much as often as experiments would do. So I think you have to look at that aspect of it. If all it is changing consciousness, you know, it's possible to summon Hermes. Well, Hermes is just a state of consciousness that's really speedy, that makes you want to orate and talk and write poetry and communicate with people. That's what the god Hermes stands for, same as the, you know, Thoth, the scribe, or Odin, or Ogma, or any of these gods who are about communication and language and speed, and also deception and trickery. But it's just a state of mind that, you know, a Viking would conjure Odin to get that same state of mind. And that would be Odin. Odin would be there because that's the name of that state of consciousness, and it's super highly focused. So God states are incredibly highly focused and humans can't maintain them for long. That's why we're not all gods, but the God persists because that guy next to you can also summon Hermes, and Hermes is as absolutely present within him. So Hermes is more like a distributed field, and all the gods are, and they don't have to be supernatural to be absolutely real and also eternal in terms of the human experience, because any human from any point in time can experience that sense. Communication, can't wait to talk. I mean, I'm talking to Doug online. I am currently possessed by Hermes, you know, waving my hands about, excited by the ideas. So that is the God, and it doesn't have to be any more supernatural than that, and it's available, and it can be brought down to very highly specific and concentrated states by magical ritual and by excluding everything from your environment that isn't Hermes related. And that's all it takes. So I think all of these things can be talked about in ways without having to invoke, you know, other realms or ghosts or things that can't be touched. You know, there are a lot of things that can't be touched, but they're undeniably real. You know, as I always say, the meaning of Hamlet is undeniably real. In fact, people could write books about it and fight over it, but you can't touch it. It's as insubstantial as Hamlet's dad's ghost, but it's real. So there are other things like that.
Right, which is the whole point of that play.
Yeah.
It's there. Yes, it's there. It's there, but you know, you can't prove nothing, but it's there. But that to me was the real value of really everybody from Aleister Crowley to John Lilly, that they're saying, do these things and you will get to this weird place. So John Lilly said, okay, once you do this, you're going to get to what I think is the 31st level. There's going to be purple people. They're going to be walking upside down. And you do all the things. You go in the tank. You take this much ketamine. You think these thoughts. You will see those. They're there.
Yeah. Because you are deliberately constructing a very specific state of consciousness that feels like contact with machine intelligence from another dimension, in Lilly's case, you know. And someone else, as you say, it can be done. It can easily be replicated. So, you know, I guess, like, that's what magic is for me. It's not the pursuit of some holy grail. It's the actual, the energizing and the enchantment of the reality of the world we live in and all the things that we've understood and maybe taken for granted and not realized can be placed together in new configurations that to other people might seem magical or unusual or supernatural, but they're not.
At the same time, though, don't you see much, your work sometimes as sigils? So, you know, when I wrote Alistair and Adolf, I saw that as a sigil to try to bring down, the corporate, the digital corporate sigil magic that they were using. You know, I mean, do you do it? And you don't, I mean, someone like you, I wouldn't think you do a sigil magic for the success of my project. You do the sigil for the purpose of the project.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also, it tends to be if I'm exploring a particular state, you know, and if it's, you know, I'll talk about it, say, in terms of the tree of life, Kabbalistic tree of life. So I'm exploring, say, Chesed. So I write All-Star Superman. It's about fathers. It's about the idea of the good father, the man in blue coming down. It's about my own father's death at the same time. And it's about a lot of other things, but it comes from that impulse. Like, it's okay, I have reached this conscious state in my explorations of the Kabbalistic tree of life, in which I've spent years in each sphere. Now I look back and it was very organized. And to know that the next thing after that is, well, I've got to really tackle the abyss now. I've been thinking about it and writing about it all my life, but now's the time to actually go through an experiential, which was awful, but fueled a whole bunch of books, like, you know, Annihilator and Nameless, which we're all dealing with that. And on the other side of that, there's the state of consciousness, which is Bina, the kind of highest female principle or feminine principle. So out of that, the desire to explore these ideas fueled, like, Lenina Crown's portrayal in Brave New World. It's fueled the whole, that three-year book Wonder Woman series that I've just finished. So all of it's kind of all of it come from specifically exploring things like that and then using, well, how can the energy from this be used for something positive? How can someone hopefully read this Wonder Woman book, the third one, and see the potential for bringing down the patriarchy using dominatrix techniques and or something like that? And each one of them becomes an interesting experiment. How do we take down these bastards using the ideas and symbols from this particular sphere? And that informs all the work that comes out of these very deliberate magical workings or sigil workings using the comics.
What does that involve from you? Do you end up picking up all these old books and reading stuff, or is it more practices and meditation, or?
It's just all of them now, because I do it all the time. It's just all integrated. It's, you know, it's the 4 mile walks, it's the swimming, it's everything's dedicated towards sitting down and trying to bring an energy onto the paper and finding symbols that will carry the energy and connect with people, and also, you know, that will honour the spirit of the character that you're working with. But the characters are always, I've always got to have something that I'm trying to say, some, you know, annoying revolutionary idea that can become a vehicle for. But yeah, I mean, all of it's practice, you know. I'll do the meditation, I'll do the dedications to the gods, I'll dedicate to Ganesh before a project, I'll talk to the appropriate gods, I'll do actual rituals and integrate it all.
I mean, I guess I have my own, you know, pantheon, my own set of knowledge. But when I talk to you or Jason Louv or someone, it's like, you guys know the whole Kabbalistic tree and everybody on it and who crosses over to where, and, oh, well, Dion Fortune says this, but then this says this. Does that...
That's the product of a misspent youth. you got an education while we were reading these books.
Yeah, but it's like it seems to be almost essential knowledge on a certain level.
And honestly, to me, all they are is like frameworks or filters or metaphors. You know, again, I know there are people who would say take the tree of life and it becomes, you know, it's a lifetime study. I agree, but some people might find in that a basis for belief or for faith. Or to me, that it's more mercenary. I mean, everything to me is. It's a way of looking at the world. You know, if I disagree with an idea, then I want to see how that idea looks through the person's eyes who's thinking it. So put it in a story. If you want to write about fascism, I'll write Darkseid, you know, Jack Kirby's ultimate villain, and try to understand what is that drive. So I just love looking at the world through different lenses, and I found it's these some of the magical lenses, they're really good for triggering new ways of thinking. You know, like I say, if you choose to believe you're in the sphere of Bina, and you now experience all this like feminine energy, you've got through the abyss. There's a certain sense of like being washed up, gasping on the beach, and being nurtured. Then you can apply it to work, and suddenly there's a new filter. You know, because I felt that, I thought, well, when I'm doing Wonder Woman, I don't want to repeat the boy hero journey. You know, I started to think, why is that regarded as intrinsically our culture's story, you know, the Joseph Campbell hero's journey? And I thought, it's actually very narcissistic in this notion of the young boy who rises up to take out the corrupt king and then ultimately replaces him. It's just this kind of downbeat, you know. And I thought, is there an alternative heroine's journey that I could use for this? And so again, so thinking out of Bina, using Bina as a filter, using Bina as a framework, I get all these new connections that I hadn't had in what you could say was the previous sphere. You know, that was the sphere of, as I say, that brought out the stuff about Superman and superheroes being, how useful can they be, and all the way down that. So all they are is it's like putting on glasses for me and seeing, yeah, how does the world work? How is information reordered from this perspective? And can that excite my creativity? Because it keeps it aflame, you know, it keeps me trying to think of new ways of seeing things.
Yeah, it's like just almost for some people, it's like picking a new character sheet. You know, I'm going to create a character. Okay, I'm going to walk around the world as if I'm a bodhisattva and everyone I look at becomes awakened. And that's my experience now.
Yeah.
And
so it's not, but you can do it with characters, and you can take them off again, which, as you know, is probably better, because it'd be so easy, again, to be possessed or to be enthused by a certain idea of who he is. Why I always resisted the kind of guru thing, you know, when I was younger, it was like all these, you know, kids would want me to be their guru or tell them how to, and I was so against that. It just seemed like I'm not in a position to tell you all of that. You know, there's things I can be helpful with, but please don't put me as an impediment in your own rise towards self-awareness. So I was always against that aspect of it. But in the stories, you can at least embody different viewpoints and set them against each other, and people can make their own decisions as to what you feel or believe at any given time.
Well, and I'd much rather someone be, you know, set up a devotional table to a character I've done than to me.
You know? Yeah, I mean, at least the character will just outlast us, you know.
It might, yeah, be. And it can be perfect. But the thing that I think part of the reason why you may run into this more than most of us is you bring, you exude a kind of a confidence, a merry self, you know, self-aware but self-confident a power. Like when we did, I'll never forget when we did that workshop at the Omega Institute.
Oh yeah, that
and is. You know, and I bring my good Jewish self-doubt approach to the world and all that, and you come and you're just like, fuck it, this is all real, we could just do it, come on, let's go. And then that evening, there was, someone had a guitar, you pick up the guitar and you start playing these John Lennon songs, and the light is emanating from the top of your skull, and I'm thinking, wow, does Grant walk around the world, do you walk through life just not doubting, just there's this, I'm gonna, it seems when I experience you, it seems as if I feel like I'm not in a bad way, like I'm more of a kind of a Woody Allen introspective, you know, getting insights by questioning my motive. Well, do I mean this? Do I not? Am I good? Am I not? Is this ethical? Is it not? And I get to great places, but that you get to places by just pedal to the metal. I'm alive. Let's just go. I mean, do you experience doubt and self-questioning in your in transit?
Well, naturally, yeah. I mean, of course I do, you know. And things go wrong, you know. I've been through the abyss. I've a lot of doubt, a lot of questioning, a lot of horror. But I just, to me, it just doesn't seem as it's not the best way to face the world. And then generally, it feels like absurdity to me. The world feels absurd. So my basic feeling is that I'm kind of in a Monty Python type thing, you know. And ultimately, anything that seems too grave or too self-indulgent becomes ridiculous. It immediately collapses into absurdity. So for me, the approach is always absurd. But, you know, I grew up in the west coast of Scotland, which is quite grim. And we weren't really given a lot of opportunities here, you know. Our parents were great and gave us books to read. But generally, by and large, you were told you would never amount to anything. You would always be a failure. So there's a lot of fear, you know. And the fact that I've done okay still bothers me, because I used all my own, the methods that I talk about, the magic and presenting a certain approach to the world, it really works, really, really works. But then I look around and I see people who it's not worked as well for them, and suddenly you do seem to have more privilege, you do seem to have done better than people. So yeah, I mean, all that, I find that, you know, there's doubt there, but I would still always, I'll just pick up a guitar. If I'm in a room and nobody's doing anything, I'll say, well, somebody's got to entertain the place, I'll just do it, I'll give it a go. And I don't think I'm that great at anything, but I think I'll just always give it a go. And the things I've given a go to longer, you know, I've achieved some mastery over them. But generally, it's just give it a go, because nobody else in the room seems to be willing to do this. If somebody else is in who's like a real guitarist and a real singer, then I'll always just sit back and be very quiet and let that happen. But yeah, I do have a sense of just, come on, you know, you're here to entertain the place. There's people watching.
Yeah, but it's also part of the spirit. I mean, you've helped so many people along the way, you know, that a lot of people, particularly in comics, they feel like they don't have elbow room for one another. It's like, oh no, you know. But, you know, I don't know how many dozens of people you brought to Karen Berger back in the Vertigo days, and you're just always there. It's like, as if, it's so weird. I mean, I guess it's in every industry, but there's this sense that if you help someone else, it's going to somehow, there's going to be less for you, you know, but you've manifest the opposite direction.
Never, you know, I mean, but it's just, again, it's just a certain wealth of, when I was working with Mark Miller, it would just be, tell me a story, and I couldn't help but then say, oh no, so if you did this, Mark, or if you tried this, if you tried that, I just couldn't help it. So anybody who comes along, and I think it's better to help people, it just is better. I mean, to get down to the basics of that, it just, it's better in every way in the long run. It's better to have the confidence to be able to help people, to not see them as competition or people who replace you. Even in comics, naturally, generations replace generations. But I still think it's, you just have to be part of that. I always think you should encourage people and tell them if they're good at something, to really tell them they're good. And if they've done a kind act, to tell them and to say you appreciate something. So I think it's important to constantly, you know, at least try and emphasize the positive with people.
But that sharing of ideas, I mean, I see it so much in comics and so little in television. You know, when I was working even on Testament, I'm talking to Dean Haspel about it, and he's like, oh, why don't you try this or do that, or you could have a character that does this. And it's like, this is what in the West Coast they would call IP, just
not
pouring
exactly
out of it.
But you know, but for us, it's just you're meeting someone else who thinks like you, and the excitement sparks and the hologram begins, and you know, you can't help but joining in. And especially I just love to let my imagination run more than anything else, and you know, again, make up nonsense. If I could just do that, which I pretty much do, what am I saying? If I could do that for a living, yeah, well, I do. But that just, I love those talks where it's just spinning out and riffing on ideas and making new things to try and make one another laugh or whatever.
Yeah, it was funny. I was with you when I had the idea for Alistair and Adolf. We were at, like in the basement of the Chrysler building at some Vertigo party, and I was like, how about this for a superhero matchup, Hitler and Crowley? You're like, oh, go for it. And it turns out they knew each other, but you know, I only found that out later. But you know, speaking about your childhood, I remember in the movie, that big movie about you, which is still around, I'm sure, the, what was that called,
Talking with God.
Yeah, Talking with God. You talk about your dad and how he was a nuclear war activist, I think. And he was part of this protest where they had these cardboard coffins.
No, this was actually inside, this was inside one of the regional seats of government where the civil service was meant to flee once the 3-minute warning was sounded. So everyone was supposed to head for the hills and leave their families behind. And within 3 minutes,
reach these seats of government where the civil service would restart civilization after the apocalypse. So my dad used to, he would infiltrate these places back when the surveillance technology wasn't up to the task, and kind of use me as a decoy sometimes. And he, all he would do is he would take pictures of them and just disseminate them out into the underground. And that was where we saw these things. They had all the coffins, and it was everyone's name in the electoral register as cardboard flattened coffins. But the most interesting thing for me was that there's a pencil sharpener, you know, one of those old school drum pencil sharpeners. And I thought, just that's so, you know, the idea that after a spirited exchange with Russia and this place right here where I'm sitting now, I'm on the base. This is where all the Britain's nuclear weapons are stored. So this is an immediate target. If anything goes wrong, this will be vaporized within seconds. And this
that's
is
a good strategy, actually.
Yeah. And so this is the place where my dad used to come protest, and the subs still go up and down in front of the house, the nuclear submarines. But he would come here. And as I say, he would take photographs, and they had pencils. They had very, very sharp pencils. So if it really went to hell and you're overrun by mutants with the eyes of spiders, you've got all these pencils to stab them with. But it was tragic. It was the tragic naivety of that, the nuclear age. But yeah, my dad had been a soldier in World War II, and he found himself just getting into more trouble with the British Army than anything else, because they were ordering him to shoot civilians in India, and he said, if anyone shoots anyone, I'll shoot the commanding officer right here and now. So they flung him in the brig, and then he threatened to kill anyone who came in to take him for a court-martial. So they just chucked him. They sent him to Burma as a paratrooper, and he came home. He'd become enamoured of Gandhi, and he got into the idea of non-violent protest. So he was a fascinating figure. He was a soldier who became a non-violent protester and was very, very involved in that for the rest of his life and working in his community. They gave him a medal in the end. You know? So
that's great. I remember right after 9/11, we had lunch at the Life Cafe, and I was saying, what are we going to do? What do we tell the kids? And you said, look, this is, the grown-ups are never going to listen to us anyway. Just keep on with what you're doing. Do your stuff. But at the same time, when I hear about your dad and social protest and Gandhi and nonviolent, do you see that we have a kind of an obligation to prevent species extinction at this point deliberately, or is that sort of not directly what you're working on?
Well, it's probably the best question to go out on. It's with my father, I mean, I was looking at how it worked with my father, and while he was able to make big differences to people in the local community, ultimately, you know, I'm still sitting on top of a nuclear arsenal. And although the Americans have left, the nuclear arsenal is still here, and we've still got problems with Russia, we've still got problems with everybody else in the world. So a lot of what he fought for, he wasn't able to change on that bigger scale. Again, with, you know, in the 80s, we all went on marches about the environment. You know, it was a big thing in the 80s. We were all out on those marches. And now you have Greta Thunberg who'll look and say, well, we inherited this mess from your generation. It's going, no, everybody inherited this mess going back generations. And, you know, I look at the civil rights images from 1968, and there's basically no difference between what you see then and Grandmaster Jay's Black Panthers of today. And so I see that kind of activism, you know, and even almost militarizing that kind of activism, not even whether it's peace activism, whether it's non-violent, it seems to fail on these bigger goals where it succeeds on the local level very much. And so I began to think of it that way, and I thought, well, what can I do? I'm not an activist like my dad. I went on marches. I mean, I did all that until he died, and then I found myself not doing any of those marches anymore, because it just seemed like I'd watched him die in a hospital bed and thought, you know, he wasn't able to change the big things that he wished he could change. So for me, it was all about using the work to at least touch people. That became my constituency would be anyone who might pick up this comic, who might receive the signal, who might hear the noise, who might feel some kind of kinship with this person who'd sent out this signal. And I thought, that's the best you can do, and to put out the good ideas through that, so that it might touch some kid in, you know, sitting in the Midwest somewhere who feels completely alone until he picks up the Doom Patrol and realises, oh, there's people who think like me, there's freaks like me, and they're out there. So that was the tack I chose to take. And I still think it is. For all we would love to change the world, and when you're younger, you think you really can do the Messiah job. You know, it's when you're a young man, you definitely is. Especially if you're a young man, you think, yeah, I'm the new Messiah, I'm going to make the difference. But I think that as the older I get, the more it's that local level is the best. You know, I've living here in this rural place, looking after all the animals here. Like, I'm saving little feral kittens every day. We work with the local animal rescue people. We, you know, make sure local businesses are... We're working with everyone. We buy our food from here. And I kind of think that works better. The temporary autonomous zone is a better idea, and it's the thing we can do on the smaller level. And then whatever talents you've got, put out the signal. But really, we are still living in the adults' world, and they're never going to listen to us. It's, you know, these people, they're super billionaires who run the planet. They are sociopathic in a lot of ways. They've been trained that sociopathy or even psychopathy is the way to get ahead. And they're applying all these techniques that aren't really working. They're not working for everyone. They might survive a bit longer than us, but ultimately they can't survive their own advances. And we are not. Are we going to go up against them? Are we going to go up against Vladimir Putin? We'd be dead in 2 days. So that's not where we can actually operate. And the old days of thinking you could somehow take over and make it better, it's the system is so complex, and it's basically run by global gangsters who operate at a level so far above us. That's where I want to keep them. I don't ever want to interact with their reality. But they've kind of, what's been used now, the fact that people are using magic now is, well, that's something we've always been good at. And the use of magic has collapsed the walls, I think, between what was real and what was illusion so thoroughly now. I've spoken to you about this before, and I said, you know, those two towers on the Tarot Moon card represent the gateway between reality and illusion. You know, Malkuth, the lower sphere, is everything material, and above us is the moon sphere. Yes, Odd, that's everything we can imagine, and it's all our delusions and our hallucinations and our daydreams and our fantasies. And that's kind of where magic is rooted, you know, because we can bring these back to enchant the material world, which in itself is just a whirling conglomerate of meaningless atoms. But we, consciousness brings meaning to those atoms. It brings meaning to everything we see. You know, when I was in the abyss studying nihilism, and I realised, I got through it by realising even these nihilist guys, the speculative realists, you know, Raymond Brassey and Thomas Ligotti, they're trying to provide meaning, even if it's an anti-meaning, or they think it's anti-meaning. That's not, they're enchanting the world with nihilism. So to me, magic always wins, because magic always, at the end of nihilism, there is magic just saying, no, consciousness, actually, everywhere it looks, it finds meaning. Even when told it doesn't, that's its joy. It just can't help but find meaning everywhere it looks, even if it's an anti-meaning. So on that level, I figure that the collapse of those two towers in 2001 were the physical manifestation of what, you know, the Kabbalists call the collapse of the 32nd path. And it's when Malkuth, the material sphere, is drawn up into Yesod, the sphere of illusion, the lunar sphere, because then it corrects the symmetry of the tree of life. But that's an apocalypse. Why is it an apocalypse? Because reality and illusion become the same thing, and we stop being able to tell them apart. And since then, we've seen, you know, and I'll always go through the same list, but we've seen comic book superheroes become more realistic in attempts made to explain the Ultimates, you know, they thought, explain how the powers would work, you know, the Iron Man. Then we have the actual characters have been created in China and in American labs to be Supermen, to be Iron Men. There are suits being created. There are attempts to upgrade the human biology. So these two things are colliding. We have virtual reality. We have reality TV. We have mixed reality, AR, fake news. There is a complete collapse, and I don't think people realise they're living through an actual apocalypse, an existential apocalypse, which saw its manifestation in those towers, which sees its metaphorical manifestation in the moon card, the trial of the card of initiation. So I think we're in a place where magic is so strong, it's everywhere. It's like, it's, you know, the president can snap his fingers and make the real unreal and vice versa. But as I say, we've always been good in that world. We've always been good with metaphor. We've always been good with making up stories. And when it becomes one story against another, then the whole battle stops being a physical. It becomes, well, who's got the best story? Who's got the best Bible? Who's got the best explanation that fits the facts but gives us a way forward? Because right now we're living through a story which kind of doesn't give us a way forward. So I'm all for Extinction Rebellion going in the streets. I'm all for tearing down the statues. I'm all for that. But I don't think, I think that's just playing the same game. And the game is now to create stories that are so powerful. And that's, you know, it's maybe not us that will do it. Maybe other people will do it. But that to me is the agenda. That's the job. And where can I get it? Can I get it on a comic? Great. Can I get it on TV? How many people can I reach with this viral spread of a better idea? And maybe that's that I'm able to fight in that arena and be useful, because I can't be useful in the physical world.
Well, you can though. I mean, coupling that the big viral, you know, narrative war with real world, very local, on the ground action. I mean, what you were describing in terms of helping real people in real life in a scaled way, that's the whole Team Human message.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, that's obviously, I mean, I'm bringing it to that close because it brings us back to exactly what you say in the book, you know, and you've come to the same conclusion. I think it seems to be that instead of trying to create mass movements, what we need is a distributed, a networked kind of thing that doesn't have figureheads, that doesn't have gurus, that doesn't have people who can be taken down so it demoralizes the rest of the structure. That's the old school, that's the boy hero thing.
Yeah.
And so, but we're still trying to get over that story, you know, and again, it's some of the things I've been doing are trying to suggest other potential stories, but I'm sure young people can push their version of the, you know, it's the idea of the net, which is very, it's very Bina, it's very feminine, you know, the notion of the network rather than the concentrated power, the distributed power, the kind of the nurturing thing. I thought it was really interesting that when the houses of the old god, the dad god, were all empty during the pandemic, people were spontaneously banging pots and pans to honour a nurturing, caring spirit, which again is the opposite of the old dad whose houses were quiet. And there was an interesting, just a kind of, you know, atavistic expression of something. And I think in that is what you're talking about in Team Human, and what I'm trying to talk about is to use the network. It's, you know, the virus is the metaphor of now. The virus is the thing that's really hurting the patriarchy and its structures. And it again is a distributed, it's a weapon that can't be confronted, it can't be lied to, it can't be talked down. It has its agenda and it's driven, and all we do is we facilitate its agenda. So that's very hard for the strong men to deal with, as we've seen. They have to go into total denial. So again, to bring it round, I think it's all moving forward. It's kind of the feminine approach is the web, the network, the distributed use of power, the linking everyone together so that everyone's supporting everyone else, and not having kings and leaders and figureheads and guys waving little red books on manifestos.
Beautiful. Well, I'll let you go work. Thanks so much.
Honestly, that was great, Doug. That was much. It was great to talk to you again. We should do this more often.
You haven't done a big media interview in a long, long time. I was looking, I mean, some journal things or outside Comic-Con, you know, about this or that, but to get in there deep is fun. And just to, I'd want to talk to you anyway. I'd want to be having this. I mean, for listeners, this is the same conversation we'd be having anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I forgot you were recording.
Thanks for being on Team Human. Our guest today was the one and only Grant Morrison.
You can get his comics anywhere or stream his two current television shows, Brave New World on NBC's Peacock or Happy on Sci-Fi. Don't forget to think about subscribing, even at the $2 a month level, to get access to my Conversations from the Vault with Timothy Leary, Terrence McKenna, and much, much more. Team Human was produced by Josh Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. Our community manager is Michael Bass. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.